This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Today in the Breakfast Grill, I have with us Professor Raja Rasia, the Distinguished Professor of Economics at University of Malaya, Wong Chen, Member of Parliament for Subang, and we are, of course, having an extended grill discussion on their impressions, the gentleman's impressions of Budget 2020. Starting with you, Professor, can we get your opinions on what you thought of Budget 2020 in terms of the good, bad and ugly?
I think the good things are that they did not slash spending. And you can obviously see that the budget deficit, even though the I can see huge amounts of funding going to the development aspect of the budget, but you also see that there's a fall in the budget deficit to 3.2%. And the good thing I find is that the many aspects of welfare are also addressed. Although of course I have my reservations when it talked about the ugly. I would have liked to see the way property markets are handled. I would have preferred to see, even though we have a glut in houses, but that's a consequence of how we managed demand supply in housing. I would have liked to see a capital gains tax raised to 50% rather than what is there. And also the introduction of a tax, however small it could be, but you need to have a tax on shares. Capital gains on shares. I didn't see that too. So in some ways, it tends to be very business-friendly, tends to be very not necessarily labor-friendly.
Wong Chen?
Okay, well, this is on the surface, it looks like it's a reduction in budget, but it's actually an expansionary budget by about 7%. That's because we took out the 37 billion of GST refunds and also income tax refunds, special refunds, which was what they implemented last year. So without that 37 billion, this is actually a 7% increase in budget. That's good overall because we are facing headwinds next year, and an expansionary approach will be good. But then, you know, everything that we look at, we have to go into the details, which is why the budget analysis aspect is important. There are a few things I'm not happy with, but I will, you know, explain that a bit further. But generally, I'm not happy about procurement issues. My view is procurement needs to come down, in particular what we call supplies and services at the OPEC side. Yeah, that is higher than Najib's time. So I'm going to raise those issues in Parliament when I debate.
Okay, well, in terms of headline numbers, of course, GDP's forecast of 4.8% for the coming years is higher than the forecast range of 4.3 to 4.7%. I think, I think the main question here is whether this number is achievable given the kind of money the government is spending plus the external headwinds, in your opinion. Professor?
It's a lot reliant on how the global economy performs. And there are, of course, two lines of prediction here. The first, which is the dominant one and was echoed by our Member of Parliament, YB, that the world is heading into a recession and it would come in 2020. Obviously, if that happens, and because Malaysia is highly dependent on exports, there will be a bearing. And especially so now when we have reorientated back our reliance from Chinese market to the U.S., largely because of what the U.S. has done to raise tariffs and impose quotas on China. So if that's the scenario that's taken, the 4.8% may not be achievable. But again, having said that, if the other line of prediction is, which is, again, it comes from new job statistics and so on, new jobs created in the U.S., if that's the case, then I think it can be achieved.
Wong Chen?
I agree with the professor. It's really the external factors that will decide whether we can meet the 4 point, you know, the so-called GDP targets that we want. The budget actually, in actual terms, in terms of the capacity to generate economic multiplier, is quite limited because, you know, we get 56 billion of development expenditure. So development expenditure is the element that try to, you know, push up the economic multiplier. That is insignificant in terms of the 1.4 billion GDP. So most of the issues about exports and growth is dependent on trade. And Malaysia, we really have to look at the budget and say, look, there's a limit to what it can achieve with 56 billion. Yeah. So let's not put too much emphasis on the budget. Go back to governance, democracy, basic thing, cut down corruption, and then make the economy more spread out and create the tax base bigger. Those are the key issues that will ensure that we at least meet the economic target for this year or next year.
Yeah, there's some elements of social welfare about this because there's expectations for returning females to the workforce. There's a lot of helicopter cash in terms of cash handouts to the needy. There's a lot of stuff in terms of handouts for the SME sector and stuff for the foreign direct investment. So just in terms of headline assumptions, do you think the 4.8% is achievable? Yes or no? Or is it too ambitious?
I think the focus on the domestic economy, it's very much to me like the sort of knee-jerk reaction we had in 2008, 2009. When exports crashed, what we did was to lower interest rates, making the claim that we'll now shift demand from exports to the domestic market, which is the case, say, if you are in India or even China. China is still very much domestic-driven, even though it exports quite a bit, relatively. Or the US, which is very little dependent on the global economy compared to its domestic economy. But down here, certain things were not done. Certain things were not done because for every unit that you produce, the import content is fairly high. Have we worked on those linkages, backward linkages? We haven't. So until and unless you do that, I would not be very confident that the fact that you have all these handouts, including a lowering of tax on SMEs from 18 to 17% will do much. It could, to me, it would lead to leakage. It would simply lead to leakage. It's a bit like, to me, one of the reasons why household debt actually exploded was because of that knee-jerk reaction, 2007, 2008. So you lower the interest rates, households start borrowing heavily, and then it immediately, quite easily manifested in household debt. You will have that sort of scenario now.
So a little bit like the shared prosperity vision to 2030, this particular budget seems like quite a populist one in terms of it being, you know, one which is necessarily race-based as opposed to one which is needs-based. And there's a very big distinction between those two. What do you think about that, Wong Chen?
Now, the shared prosperity vision, I mean, at the moment, we only have the goals and targets. We don't really see the roadmap in detail at the moment. So relating to the budget, we don't see much direction on those aspects as well. Shared prosperity, essentially, let's just get down to the crunch of it, is about sharing wealth. Sharing wealth means, for government purpose, an increase in taxation, for progressive taxation. The only thing we saw in progressive taxation, and this professor agreed with me, is only that 2% for the super rich, you know, and that's going to effectively contribute 40 million ringgit to a budget of, you know, 299 billion. It's not even a significant, it's just a tiny drop in the ocean. So shared prosperity, you have to have more progressive taxation issues, and capital gains tax is one issue that you can look at. And the other thing about shared prosperity is very simple. If you don't want to share your wealth with the poor, at least pay them better. That's the best way to do it.
Well, one might say that you are right because there's only 2,000 people being affected by this higher tax burden of 30%. But then equally as well, they've also raised the minimum wage, I think, the assumptions as well, and for SMEs as well. Do you think the government did enough to raise minimum conditions there?
No, absolutely not. Because, you know, you increase another 100, right? So you got now 1,002. But we are not sure what the government has said. It said that in certain big cities, no definition has been given, so we need at least 2 or 3 weeks before the government come out, which cities are affected. But our promise at the manifesto was 1,005. I do fully understand that some companies are worried about this increase. But we all know, and Professor Rasia is probably the expert on poverty issues in Malaysia, we have a standard set by Bank Negara which says that the living wage should be 2,007. Even the Pakatan promise of 1,005 is way short of that. You know, but you have to do something because this is not really about economic growth per se. This is about eliminating desperation in society.
But then there's the concomitant issue about weak business conditions. And if you raise minimum wages, then it's a cost to the business sector. You have to decide which one is more important, raising GDP and raising the economy or looking after the bottom half.
Sorry, I don't want to get into the professor's space, but let me just address this quickly. If you give people, poor people, a bump in their pay, and in our structure, we are going to do a co-pay system exactly like the Singaporean government. This is not all loaded onto the corporations. If poor people get an increase in pay, the domestic consumption increases as well. Because poor people are not taking the money and putting in London property, right? They're just spending locally. So the companies may face 6 months of some sort of cash flow issue. But after 6 months, when this money go back to the domestic economy and create services and new goods, it will take care of itself. This is the moral question. It's not really so much an economic question, but even on an economic basis, it makes a lot of sense.
There's also this issue of 5 billion ringgit in subsidies direct to the people. And that's not a small number. It comes in a whole bunch of different forms. Prof?
I think one of the problems I found is that we have a select parliamentary committee that was supposed to review what constitutes the poverty line income. And this comes from a critique directed by the UN special reporter, making the he simply was blunt. He says, we are cheating with our poor people. Not only that, we are not including people who are not identified because of the fact that they don't have proper addresses and so on, especially those who are living orang asli and so on. But at the same time, we have capped an income. The 980 ringgit poverty line income that was used to measure the 0.4% incidence of poverty in 2016, in real prices, would have been 50 ringgit in 1970 prices. We use a compounded consumer price index. That's what you'll get, about 3.5%. You'll get to that figure. Two problems with that. One of which is we did not differentiate geographically the cost of living. Secondly, we did not change that income because the essentials change as countries face structural change. So if you have an incidence of poverty of about 17% in Britain, over 15% in the US, we look really good, but in reality, we are not. Now, that should have been reflected here. And is that, as what YB Wong Chen just mentioned just now, 2,700 was the figure that the World Bank gave. Of course, they used the multidimensional poverty index, which has other proxies too. But I think in this case here, my own assessment would have been like 3,000 ringgit. And the minimum wage is only 1,200. Although, of course, I accept the finance minister, when presenting the budget, he made the case that they didn't know they had that much of debt, and they will eventually come to that sort of figures, the 1,500 that they promised. But my feeling is this 5 billion you just noted, how much will that be? That's one. Second, how much of it will be leaked out across borders? These are things they should actually have estimated before making a case that it will really say will have a dent, will have an impact on the masses. Until and unless that's done, some of us may think that it's still populist.
I'm talking this morning to Professor Raja Rasia, the Distinguished Professor of Economics at University of Malaya, and Wong Chen, Member of Parliament for Subang. We are, of course, discussing Budget 2020 and the gentleman's impressions of that. We'll be back after these messages, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Professor Raja Rasia, the Distinguished Professor of Economics for University of Malaya, and Wong Chen, Member of Parliament for Subang, is with me on the grill this morning, and we are, of course, discussing Budget 2020. Now, the very politically unfeasible GST did not make a return, as expected, Wong, in Budget 2020, but we also saw no expansion of the SST net. So our question really is, in terms of the income side of the equation where the budget is concerned, how do you think the government's going to cover its expenses in terms of where the money is going to come from?
Well, the SST, the projected SST is about 28 billion next year. I think that is way better than the original projection, which was 22 billion. So that's your additional 6 billion coming in. Overall, the tax base is, of course, weak. I mean, year in, year out, we've been complaining about this forever. And this is linked to the last item that Prof and I talked about wages. Minimum wage, if you put 1,005, you reverberate upwards most of the wages. The key point is that it should reverberate so much so that 3,006, which is the baseline for paying your tax, increases as well. Then you have a bigger, stronger personal income tax base.
What do you think the government didn't do it?
Well, first, a big policy such as this needs a roadmap of, say, 5 years to implement or 10 years to implement. Now, that roadmap hasn't been given in detail to us, nor the Budget Select Committee. So I'd like to see the MOF sitting down and telling us this is our perception, because we need to address this systemic issue about revenue.
In North America, there's this growing wave of support for universal basic income. I think the biggest proponent there is this guy called Andrew Yang. It's gaining momentum. Do you think there's a proposition for that here in Malaysia, Prof?
I'd like to address this in the context of what YB Wong mentioned just now. I think I can see the position of employers. I can see the position of the employers that if you raise wages without productivity going up, except that they tend to blame they tend to blame the workers when productivity is down. They should collectively bear that responsibility. But having said that, we now have, in manufacturing, for example, a foreign labor force largely comprising unskilled workers, about 70%. And therefore, value added in gross output of most of these industries are actually somewhat declining on a downward trend. I have those figures myself from UNIDO, if you compare with, say, Korea or even Singapore. Now, until and unless something is done, especially the science, technology, and innovation infrastructure that our current prime minister launched in the 90s, for all these huge parastatals that were created, they are important, though, but there's very little connectivity with the firms, and there's very little performance. Unless they proactively generate that sort of productivity increase, it's difficult to increase one side of the economy, which is the side of what workers face, and then expect that you, at the same time, remain competitive to export. We need to do that before we can do that, and we have to do it very quickly.
There's also this issue of the disparity in the wealth gap, and of course, Moody's was one of the contrarian remarks in terms of not lauding the budget, but pointing out the concerns that it might have for postponing the fiscal deficit target. What did you think about that when you saw the postponement of those fiscal deficit targets, Wong?
Well, you see, a deficit has two functions. One is to try to deficit spending for expansionary purposes, right? But really, the Malaysian problem about deficit is the lack of income from the government. So as I said, we need that roadmap to be rolled out as soon as possible so that we can see on a long-term basis, 5 to 10 years, what is the direction we're going. Let me address the universal basic income also. We're not ready. We're not there. We can't even look at conditional payouts, right? We're not even doing that. We're just doing BSH, almost like BRIM, without any conditions. Universal basic income, what they're doing in Finland and what they're proposing by Edward Young, is way 10 years in advance of us when we have artificial intelligence issues. You know, when we have robotics taking over jobs, then you got unemployment 15-20%. We're not nowhere there. So I think the underlying issue is the government budget must be used for good. It must be used either for the corporations, which are, in my term, and I used to be a corporate lawyer, this is a funny thing to say, but in my terms, the corporations are not the best behaving people. Or you use it for the social aspect.
Well, a lot of people are saying that this budget 2020 is very business friendly, and it is, right? But at the cost of what? And a lot of people say that at the cost of the people, as you say, Wong, it could have been very politically expedient for the government to say, let's raise minimum wages to 1500 and at the cost of the corporations. And even ideas, for example, have suggested a living wage tax credit, where if corporations voluntarily increase wages for its people, then it gets a tiered tax reduction on the corporate tax level. And there was a proposition for that, which was, of course, not adopted. So has the government sacrificed people at the altar of business policy?
Let me address this in real empirical numbers, okay? We know corporate tax in Malaysia is about 70, 75 billion a year. And we know that all 14 million, 15 million Malaysian workers contribute from personal income tax a miserable number of, 30, 32 billion. So you can see the corporations are super rich in terms of their profitability at the expense of the workers. Now, that ratio is 2.5 times for corporates compared to all the workers. You go to Europe, it's the other way around. People should be richer than the corporates by 2.5 times. In Singapore, it's 50-50, right? So if you want to grow the country, you want resilient, you want innovative workforce, you've got to pay them. That's it.
And then the government wants, under the shared prosperity vision, workers' incomes to be 48% of GDP. Yes. Is that a highfalutin target?
No, I don't think it's too far. I mean, it's good. I mean, this
is something's got to happen to make that happen.
Yeah, so come out the roadmap, give us a 10-year plan, and then every budget, you address this issue towards that point.
Did you see that in this budget?
No, definitely not in this budget.
So why do you think that? Because a lot of people expected budget 2020 to be a precursor, early salvos at shared prosperity. That's not happening, in your opinion.
Well, the political issue is quite simple. The cabinet's got to get their act together. The MOF in particular have to talk to MEA, because MEA is given the task of, driving the SPV, right? So they got to improve their communications with each other and try to set a real thing. So again, you can announce SPV without a proper roadmap, detailed roadmap, which the MOF will buy in, you won't see anything.
Of course, the finance minister also said that tax collection is 13% of GDP. That lags most other developed economies. The target is to increase that percentage, right? How do you think it's going to get there, Prof?
I mean, going back to your earlier question, which should really start the issue involved. I think if you're looking at a social welfare state, the type the Nordic countries are, or even Germany, you should expect to have wages constituting somewhat like 60%, and not even the 48%. While we have those figures there in the SPV, meaning the Shared Prosperity Vision, the budget itself doesn't seem to reflect very much that movement towards that. We know that in many of these countries, you have disparities really growing, whether it's the UK or whether it's the US, except for countries like the Nordic countries. Now, if we are seriously concerned about that, then we need to deal with issues that would empower the people. And of course, what we see is, in terms of goodies, a number of subsidies given here and there, but they are actually peanuts in many sense. One. Second, one needs to see whether these target groups that they are subsidizing themselves will be enabled, that they no longer will come back for subsidies. There's no element of that there. So my feeling is these are important instruments they should take into account when they implement the budget, because not many things are clear as to how, as the YB himself mentioned, we will have to expect that these things are done. And my own feeling is, in the past, not much of that sort was done. I hope there will be a change in that.
Wong, do you think there's an extension of Malaysia's already welfare state, you know, realm?
Well, welfare state can only take place if it's funded by reasonably high taxes. In the Malaysian case, you don't have to pursue high taxes because we have this wonderful thing called Petronas, and we have this oil wealth, gas wealth that God gave us. What we need is more transparency and accountability on how this money is used. That is the point. We can gradually move towards a higher tax system if people are happy. If the roads are clean, there is no crime, I'm sure, Chuan, you'll be happy to pay 32% tax even to trade off that. I mean, if you go to Norway, you see that's absolutely wonderful. There's no crime. People are happy. They're the happiest people in the world. And yet they pay 40, 45, 50% tax rate.
But they get an education system, which is excellent. Infrastructure, good police force, excellent military. But that's not the case in Malaysia. So I think when you talk about Petronas, that's a big issue, right?
No. Well, John, let me explain this. So we're nowhere there, right? But we want to go there. So what is the wonderful thing we have? We have Petronas money to bridge that transition. It's just that Petronas cannot be just, you know, in the purview of the Prime Minister alone. It has to go back to Parliament. They have to tell us how much money, how to spend it. I mean, that's the point. So, you know, I'm not advocating high taxes. I don't want to pay tax. You don't want to pay tax, right? But
if I earn 2 million ringgit a month, a year, I wouldn't mind paying high tax as well.
If you earn 2 million ringgit a month or whatever the amount is in Norway, you'll be paying 50%, my friend. Yeah. Not 32.
So when you look at the price assumptions for oil at $62 a barrel versus what it was, 72 a year ago, even that is volatile, right? It jumps all over the place now. Prof, do you think that is too risky an assumption? Because Petronas is 30 billion ringgit in special div every year, give or take.
I mean, you would expect oil prices to go up and down. We have a history to make that sort of point. I think what is important here is, and that actually also leads to more accountability, is a tax on all exports. That's what Norway does. It's got a tax on all exports, and there is a set of stakeholders. They include civil society there too, that actually influence the way it's allocated, rather than simply leaving the entire thing to government. Having said that, it's also important for us to understand that it's not easy for us to raise taxes. Why? You have a corporate tax of 14% in Singapore. We have 24% here. The fear people have here is it would actually lead to multinationals relocating where they get the best options, best set of goodies. In a way, also the transfer price. I certainly believe that there's a lot of transfer pricing that leads to a recording of more profits in Singapore because they pay much less taxes. Now, these things need to be really examined carefully, and I don't have the figures on those things.
I'm talking this morning to Professor Raja Rasia, the Distinguished Professor of Economics at UM, and Wong Chen, Member of Parliament for Subang. We are discussing Budget 2020. We'll be back after the news with more sectoral analysis after the break. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Professor Raja Rasia, a distinguished professor of economics at University of Malaya, and YB Wong Chen, Member of Parliament for Subang, with me on the grill this morning, we're discussing Budget 2020. Wong, starting with you, YB, a multinational corporation is getting R1 billion a year in allocation for customised incentive packages over the next 5 years. Of course, the intention is to attract Fortune 500 companies here. As you were saying, it's a business-friendly budget. What do you think of that particular measure?
Let's be very clear about investment. If a foreign direct investment comes into Malaysia, they come in for many factors. Getting a tax incentive is one of the many factors. But the big factor is really about availability of land, the quality of the labour, the rule of law issues, what kind of percentage they're going to cede away for, you know, either Bumi Putra program or pro-Malaysia program. Those are the main issues. So, you know, if you put in incentives in the budget up to R1 billion, you may swing a bit. But primarily, going forward in Malaysia, as you know, last year, the corporations and fat cats in Malaysia got R37 billion of payout from the government. There's a lot of money floating around.
GST refunds.
Yes, GST okay. And income tax refund. Lots of money floating around, but where's the investment? Yeah.
So was it domestic investment or did they put it abroad?
No, that's the thing. We suspect a lot of money went out. I did speak to the bank governor on one occasion and asked her, but she couldn't give me the numbers. But I suspect a lot of money went out because that's why the ringgit has come down, even though there's a lot of money in the markets, so to speak. But the key point is this. If you are a big Fortune 500 companies, the first thing you ask is, where's my domestic guys? Why are they not investing in this country? If they are not investing, why should I? A 2% tax incentive or 5% or 10-year tax holiday is not going to swing it for me. And all the domestic guys are waiting for the political scenario to unfold. And that's the main point.
Prof, are you going to agree or disagree with YB?
I think to a large extent what he's saying hits the whole thing in the right sort of direction. Let me just give you some examples. There are countries like Korea, and meaning South Korea and Taiwan. These countries have per capita incomes that risen from levels that were lower than ours, and from 79, Koreans went up higher, and they're several times higher. Now, Singapore has organized a strategy to attract multinationals, not the case with Korea and Taiwan. What is important here is, if you follow the Singapore strategy, you will then need to see whether these firms are important for you. Singapore uses a leveraging strategy. They make mistakes too. They attracted disk drive firms in the late 80s. They found that was wrong. Very quickly, they got it out. Now they realize that semiconductor firms are not going to be the type of firms they need. Very quickly, they're removing them. Now, we don't have that sort of flexibility one. Second, we even haven't organized strategies to appropriate technology transfer from these firms. Now, if that's the case, you are basically, we call them implicit subsidies. Why should we actually provide those subsidies? Simply because you want to have a Fortune 500 firm here. I think it really is necessary for people to rethink these things to see if actually the attraction, relocation of these big multinationals would actually benefit national firms. If it's not going to, then you're not actually wasting resources. That's exactly what I would think.
Okay, so moving on to the SME sector, and I think that there was a recognition that SMEs make up 98.5% of the entire economy and nearly 40% of GDP. They've also decreased the effective tax rate to 17%.
From 18.
In terms of also the chargeable tax level from, I think, 500,000 to 600,000. Do you think that was enough to galvanize the SME economy?
Not really. I mean, look, my SME friends, and I do have a lot out there, will tell me that they're going to go for a capital reduction exercise to try and get that, you know, that reduction on taxation. I mean, SMEs are clever. They are resilient. They are very mobile. What they need is not, they don't really need a tax incentive program per se. What they really need is government spending a lot of money on R&D and giving them those or sharing those R&D results with them. That's really what is going to drive Malaysian SME from a low-cost producer full of foreign workers to automotive and, you know, and robotics, and also, you know, the next IR 4.0, if you want to use those words. I don't really like the terminology. But, you know, if you want to push that direction, that's the way to do it.
Which then begs the question, how much stakeholder engagement did the Finance Ministry, in fact, the government, have where the formulation of Budget 2020 was concerned? Prof, were you consulted or YB, were you consulted?
Do you know who was consulted? I wasn't consulted, but they actually mentioned a number of organizations, people they interviewed. I don't know who they interviewed, but I have my take on this. If you look at success of SMEs, you will then in Asia look at Taiwan. Now, we even have a Malaysian successful businessman who studied there. He applied to get an incubator in Malaysia. He was rejected. He turned a $900,000 firm into a billion-dollar firm in 5 years. In fact, I connected people from Kadana with the guy. This is Paw Kien Sing, Sikkim Chan-born guy. Now, what I can tell you is we have a huge diaspora out there. We have not attracted them because the incentives are not good. Sometimes it's not even incentive. It's a passion that you want to give them that you are Malaysian. That's important. But more importantly, I think SMEs have access to a number of incentives. But has there been a profound review of them? So that in the first place itself, you will ensure that your selection process is good. Everybody makes mistakes. So the case with the Taiwanese, the Koreans, and Japanese, but they try not to repeat those mistakes because they have a profound review. Second, they monitor them to see if they are actually connected to the right sort of peristaltics. The science parks that they have there, the incubators that they have, that they have very high return on investment. Ours, many of them say that we have gajah putih here, in white elephants. Now, a review needs to be done there to make sure that they are recalibrated to perform so that these SMEs themselves will get the knowledge input that they require, which includes business advisory services, connecting them to markets, things that can sell, which includes capabilities that need to acquire in order to compete in global markets. I think these are more important than simply talking all the time about incentives.
Well, it's a good point that you raised, Prof, because whether it's Paw Kien Sing or whether it's Hyflux of Singapore, whether it's even FusionX out of the UK being listed on names, there's a huge diaspora of what once was with Malaysian SMEs. Rather than attracting Fortune 500, why has there not been that concern to reattract Malaysian, now not no longer SMEs, but giants? What do you think is the reason?
I saw that Paw Kien Sing was invited back. I think he's even got a doctorship. But eventually, I sent my own student, who is now a lecturer in. This is Yap Xiao Shan. She's a student a lecturer in Europe. I think what they were looking for here weren't available for them, because if you look at a person like Paw Kien Sing, he's not just a guy who's looking for rents. He's looking at what sort of ecosystem that you have, what sort of role he can play to, say, support Silterra, for example, which is, to me, the worst firm in the semiconductor industry, from the kind of statistics we have from Gartner. Now, I think that requires institutional change. The institutional change that we are talking about requires the right sort of people out there. And if they don't perform, you must remove them. And a lot of these people require tacitness. It's like what Wu Taiwan and Maurice Chang did. They were not only connected to the leading labs, they're also connected to buyers and suppliers. They have a vision that few of us will have. I mean, none of us will have, I would say that. Because when they got back, they carried the tacitness, the linkages, everything, the entire thing back, connecting with this whole body of network of knowledge nodes. Now, we have Malaysians there, including the R&D director of the world's leading logic firm, TSMC in Taiwan. The R&D director is a Malaysian. I think if we follow a right sort of strategy, which is colorless, colorblind, we cannot go ethnic-wise in that sense. I'm sure we'll have a better strategy.
There's a lot of ifs and assumptions there, Prof. But what is not an assumption is the 64 billion ringgit that's been allocated to the education ministry, the biggest allocation by far than any other ministry. And there's a lot of welfare concerned aid in that on that particular front, especially for low income and rural Bumiputras and Mara and TVET initiatives. YB, what do you think of when you saw that 64 billion?
I'm a bit surprised because they had 60 billion last year, and you know there's a popular perception out there that ministry is not particularly performing. So to get additional 4 billion, they really have to justify where that money is going. In my own area of Subang, you know, I had to spend 2.6 million of my own community money to repair 51 of my schools, right? So I want to see the ministry doing that, not me doing that job for him. So I think this is where the budget analysis is so important. We have to make sure every ministry is accountable. And for that to happen, Chuan, the biggest story, the biggest, most important thing we can do is to reform parliament and bring back select committees to monitor each and every ministry.
I'm talking this morning to Professor Raja Rasia, Distinguished Professor of Economics at University of Malaya, and YB Wong Chen, Member of Parliament for Subang. We're discussing Budget 2020. We'll be back after these messages. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Professor Raja Rasia, Distinguished Professor of Economics at University of Malaya, and YB Wong Chen, Member of Parliament for Subang, with me on the grill this morning, but discussing Budget 2020. Now, staying on the Education Ministry's allocation, gentlemen, I couldn't help but recall, YB, your earlier discussion on procurement and that being top of your concerns. Why do you think that the Education Ministry, which hasn't performed, at least anecdotally speaking, from a year ago, is getting a 4 billion ringgit, well, in fact, essentially an 8% bump in budget? I want to reference this, what I heard, at least anecdotally, 1.7 billion ringgit for morning meals for all Malaysian school students. Word is it that one state has, every state has just one main con to dole out these breakfast meals. So is this a microcosm of Malaysia Inc. and work?
The question to me or to Professor Rasi?
I think either one of you, lah.
Yeah.
You start, then I'll finish.
Okay. We're not sure whether it's going to be, what are the details are, but we know for certain there are 10,000 schools in Malaysia. Right, so you can either break it down by county or by state. If they want to implement such an ambitious program, I think they really have to give full disclosure. And I sit in the Public Accounts Committee. I don't have information as detailed as possible to give an informed comment on this matter.
But have you been busy at the PAC, YB?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
more busy than a year ago?
Yeah. I think we had up to now, 2019, about 40 or almost 52 hearings already. So we have been just swamped with work. But let me just address the issue. If I put on my PAC hat, I mean, I have a lot of comments about, you know, economic policy and stuff like that. Just let me deal with the supplies and services procurement. PAC is there to investigate corruption and wastage. Supplies and services under Najib, right? And we all know that, you know, that government is suspect. Like, let's put it that way. I don't want to make allegations of corruption, but that government is suspect. In 2017, they spent 34 billion, almost 35 billion on procurement of goods and supplies, right? Today, for 2020, we're going to spend 38.5 billion. That's an increase on Najib spending. That means that, you know, the space for wastage and possible corruption has actually expanded in terms of absolute numbers. And I'm worried about that because, you know, already PAC is like sitting 50, 60 days a year.
So hang on, I thought this new government was basically elected and voted in on a platform of corruption eradication. What's happened on that agenda?
I think it's still on. It's just that the macro number raises an issue, whether, you know, we're addressing the issue about open tender, whether we're addressing issue about negotiated tender. We need proper guidelines. And the numbers tells you that how come we're increasing procurement? It shouldn't be. And on top of everything else, during Najib's time, we had 1.6 million civil servants. Now we got even less, 1.4. Some have been shifted to contract. So by right, even by sheer number, same level of so-called procurement standards, right? We should be less than 35 billion.
Prof?
Yeah, I actually like this question that you posed. I got excited again with politics, Malaysian politics, because of this rallying cry by our Prime Minister, Dr. Mahathir Mohamad. Against kleptocracy, against corruption. I like that very much. Now, having said that, we have a budget of about 64 billion for the education, which is one of the highest when you compare with Korea, Taiwan, and even Singapore as a share of GDP. And then 1.7 billion, your more specific question going to the school kids for meals. My problem with that is I love very much the fact that you're helping the poor. Surely, I think no one should doubt that or even question that. But we have actually a history. Remember the national service we had before, where meals were served for the a compulsory national service for our school students. Now, at the end of it, you had kids dying, you had all sorts of problems, and then this revelation that there was a whole lot of cronyism and disjunctures that included corruption there. What guarantee do we have? Especially so, I can make this case, having such a high share of the budget going to education against GDP, we have team scores, science and maths, that where Malaysians perform worse than Vietnamese. And that's one. Second, the number of students going to do sciences has been falling as a share, and there's concern about STEM. We are not really addressing these very fundamental problems. I would really like to see how, institutional change will ensure that we achieve those things rather than just simply keeping high amounts of budget for education.
Okay, moving on to the logistics and infrastructure sectoral discussion here, there's a lot of money being thrown into rural roads and electrification of buses, and specifically there's a clear focus on Sabah, Sarawak as well in terms of development expenditure for the state governments there. Do you think this is a politically expedient move, or do you think it was really one which is needs-based? YB?
I think it's one of the positive aspects of the budget. I think we're going to spend on paper $12.2 billion on transport, and that's so important. I mean, you know, in terms of fighting climate change, in terms of just doing everything, public transportation is important. So I don't have real quarrels about, you know, allocation, but as to reflect what Prof. Rasia said, you know, we need accountability on who's been given these contracts, was it open tender, and so on and so forth. So I'm quite happy with the spending on economic multiplier for transportation.
Do you think the government should buy plus, or do you think at least the EPF should even consider buying plus?
No. Okay, this issue is really, look, everybody wants to come in, but and on what terms? Are they getting the so-called, the management of the system, or are they buying the debt? That is a fundamental question. I don't see any company who can make $1 billion a year wanting to take $24 billion of debt. Okay? So there is a lot of confusion out there. Deals are being struck, or proposals are being made, but there's no clarity at what point and what are they buying. The terms need to come out. So I'm sure my government, my Pakatan government, is committed 100% to full transparency and accountability. But it's not, to some extent, it's my job to ask as a member of parliament, but I can't be asking 200 questions in parliament. It's really, there must be a committee on transport that needs to be formed, a select committee on transport, who can then drill down, 7-member committees, drill down this issue about the toll. It cannot be in the purview of just the Prime Minister or MOF to discuss. They have to be accountable to Parliament.
Well, talking about the green economy and climate change, I think there's been some stuff on green technology as well. There's a green investment tax allowance and green income tax exemption extending to 2023. There's also a 70% income tax exemption up to 10 years for solar leasing businesses. Do you think that's enough for a green economy, Prof?
I think that's a good start, especially so when you have a glut in the energy market. Why we mentioned earlier, we have something like 40% excess. Now, the fact that we need to go green, it's inevitable, not just because Malaysia signed the Paris Accord in 2015 and that we need to eventually get to 45% of our economy to be green by 2030. From the minister's standpoint, we are supposed to get to 20% by 2025. So it's giving the right sort of signals. But I think at the same time, I hope execution will reflect that.
I'm very interested in climate change issues. I mean, you know, since the government has, I don't have much to do other than PAC. I've been looking at climate change quite often. I'm a bit surprised that there's no climate change package, so to speak. The solar power issue is interesting, but we have a major reserve margin of 35 to 40%. In fact, the way I would approach this is really to slap a basic moratorium on any new power plant, whether it's solar, wind, or whatever it is, whatever good intentions you have there, and phase out all the coal. And over time, over 10 years, when the reserve margin drops to 15% or 20%, then reinstitute solar power plants. I think it's a mispricing on priority.
In an oblique reference to what you just said, YB, what did you think when the climate change minister, you'll be in, was shunted aside when the issue of Linus was... obviously, she gave her deadlines to Linus in Kuantan, but then she was overruled by the Prime Minister. Do you think that indicates why you just mentioned what you just mentioned?
No, I think she's got a really tough job. She's a first-term MP, right? And then the cabinet office obviously has a very strong view on Linus and the Prime Minister in particular. This is all connected to the samurai bond, you know? The Japanese are ultimately the so-called invisible owner of Linus. So I think she's just in a difficult position. I mean, I respect her professionalism in this kind of thing, but at one point, this kind of thing should be open to a committee in Parliament. Again, I stress, this idea that we are not accountable, that we are hiding things, I don't think that's true. The culture of Pakatan is to be transparent and accountable, but you have to create the structure to do it. And that structure must be parliamentary reforms.
Okay, we've got about a minute left. So I think just in summation, the impression I get from both of you is that business really and corporations have trumped social welfare, even environmental concerns in at least Budget 2020. What are your closing thoughts on what you've just, you know, in terms of the weekend's digesting of the budget? Maybe with you, start with you, Prof, and end with you, YB.
My own take is I have nothing against the fact that on balance, indeed, business has triumphed over welfare. Having said that, my concern is, have we actually evaluated these incentives? What sort of incentives are generating what sort of benefits? I haven't seen that very much. A number of incentives, to me, are still somewhat in the sense of directing firms towards transferring technology or for firms to upgrade their redundant in that sort of sense. A number of these incentives are actually a waste on the government because you quite clearly can see that it tends to be cast too wide in many different ways. So my own feeling is there needs to be a review that looks at two things. One, whether there is a real connect between what is given as incentives, and the second one obviously means whether it's enabling the achievement of our goals.
Okay, gentlemen, I'm afraid we've run out of time, so we've got no more time for remarks, but thank you for your insights and your opinions, and we value what you might say in maybe 12 months' time, precisely, for Budget 2021. Talking to Professor Raja Rasia, Distinguished Professor of Economics for University of Malaya, and YB Wong Chen, MP for Subang. This is BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, Frost & Sullivan's Malaysia Mobile Service Provider of the Year.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.